Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. And what's the date today? It's the 3rd. Yeah, it's March 3rd. So let's take a look at our schedule right here. No, that's February 3rd. Here's March 3rd. We're going to cover joints today, or at least get into that chapter, and maybe finish it up today. I hope so. And when is your next test? Your next test is, lecture exam is the 17th. Is that showing pretty good? Yeah, it's showing okay. And that is 2 weeks from today, on Monday. All right, so everybody is aware of that. And the chapters that are involved are 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, but not that introductory chapter to nervous system. That's not on there. So that module is not opened up yet in Blackboard because it's on the next lecture test. Now, there is a mistake on this schedule because Lab Practicum 2 is not the week of the 17th and 19th. It's the week after. So on the 24th and 26th, you'll have your respective lab quizzes. Right, so is everybody aware of that? And you know what to be studying, right, for the lecture exam and the practicums and all that stuff? What's the answer key to the lab practicums? The lab manual, yeah, lab manual. So probably you should be looking at your textbook and the lab manual every day, maybe just for 10 minutes or 5 minutes. Even if you only have 5 minutes, it's worthwhile to open it up and take a look, right? Because it makes things so much easier to learn with repetition. You don't have to study nearly as long or as hard if you just use repetition in your study techniques. Okay, so that's all I think I want to say about the schedule, unless there's a question. Any questions? No, you're good? Okay. And so last time we covered appendicular skeleton, and oh look, we're going to talk about motions today. Wow, that's nice. Ooh, that makes my job a whole lot simpler if I can talk anatomy to you, and then you know what I'm talking about. That's really, really nice. All right, so last time, what did we talk about last time? Appendicular skeleton. So we're talking about bones. Bones of what part of your body? Your upper appendage and your lower appendage, right? I just don't want to say arm, because this thing right here is a whole lot more than your arm, right? What else is it? It's your arm. What else? It's your forearm. Three more things. Your wrist, your hand, and your fingers. They all have special bones. Fingers, what are the bones that make up fingers? Phalanges, bones that make up the hand, are the metacarpals, right? The bones that make up your wrist are the carpals. Bones that make up your forearm are the radius and ulna. And all the bones that make up the arm? I heard femur and a whole bunch of different stuff. But it's really what? Humerus. Good. And there's only one. And that pretty much is all the bones of the upper appendage, except we left out the bones that are necessary to attach that upper appendage to your axial skeleton. What are the names of that? What's the name of that bone that attaches your upper appendage to your axial skeleton? Clavicle. And also the scapula, they're grouped together. They completely surround your body, right, and superior thorax. So those are called the pectoral girdle, right, pectoral girdle. All right, so the scapula and the clavicle. Okay, so some of you might have been having a little bit of a hard time with that last question. So maybe you should have in your mind what the axial skeleton is. What is the axial skeleton? Starting here. Skull, yeah, cranium, skull, then vertebral column, and your neck is a part of that, all the way down to your tailbone is your vertebral column. What do you call a tailbone? Coccyx, yeah, all the way down to the coccyx, that's the vertebral column, part of the axial skeleton, and then don't forget, ribs and sternum as well. So there has to be something to attach your appendages to those structures, and we just got done talking about for the upper appendage. What about the lower appendage? It's nice. You don't have to remodel your thinking very much because in the thigh you've got one bone, in the leg you've got two, in the ankle you've got eight, in the foot you've got five, just like your hand, and the phalanges, same number and arrangement of phalanges in your digits as well. Okay, but what about that girdle? for your lower appendage. What do we call that? Yeah, the pelvic, I almost said the wrong thing. Yeah, pelvic girdle. And what's the bone that on one side makes up the pelvic girdle? Yeah, the os coccyx. And remember, there are three bones during development that fuse together to make an os coccyx, the ilium, ischium, and pubis. So probably you should have a pretty good idea of what the anterior, posterior, in that group of bones. What bone are you sitting on right now? Yeah, the ischium, and that's why they named it ischium, because you compress all that tissue, and when blood can't get to a tissue, it becomes ischemic. That's how we talk about it, and so that's how that bone got named. All right, so that's what we talked about last time. This time, we're going to talk something that's going to sound a whole lot more like physiology than anatomy, but a little bit of anatomy in here, and that is joints. All right, so what the heck is a joint? What's another name for a joint? It's an articulation. Yeah, articulation. Yeah, we use that term quite a bit, I think, in here already. That's nice. All right, so articulation or joints, the same thing. Joint, oh, articulations, nice. All right, so we're going to classify joints. And we're going to know a couple different systems. All right, so joints can either be classified by their structure or they can be classified by their function. And sometimes, when you know the structure, you know what the function is. And there's some different kinds of structures that can make each of these different kinds of functional classes. So we're going to look at all of that. All right, so let's look at the structural classification first. Based on material that binds the bones together. All right, that's structure. They can be fibers, they could be cartilage, or they could be a synovial joint. Synovial joint is a special kind of joint. It has a number of pieces. Well, fibrous and cartilaginous, basically one piece all the way across the joint. So let's take a look at some of these. All right, so here we have some fibrous joints. And here is a suture, right? A joint between two bones in the skull. And what can you tell me about the mobility of this suture right here? It's immovable, right? And so so sutural joints typically are immovable. I can't think of an example where that's not true. Okay, here is another fibrous type of joint. We call this a syndesmosis, and it's a joint that's held together by a lot of fibrous tissue, and it's a ligament, right? So a bone-to-bone connection is exactly the same material as a tendon. It's very strong. If you pull it from end to end, it just doesn't get damaged. Pull it from side to side, then it can actually rip and tear along the long length right here. All right, so we call this a syndesmosis, and usually it's highly stabilizing. It's almost immovable. And here we see one between the fibula and the tibia. Another kind of fibrous joint is between the alveolus, which is the socket that the root of a tooth fits into. All right, so here are all of the periodontal ligaments. And there's pain receptors in these things. Right, have you ever been chewing on something, maybe a hot dog, and there was a piece of bone in there, and you chewed down thinking that there wasn't going to be a bone, and it kind of tweaks your tooth a little bit and produced a little pain? And that's because these ligaments right here got stretched out. So from the practicum, you know this is the alveolar process between teeth, right? Margin is kind of going in and out of the plane of this image so that we don't see it. All right, so these are really good examples of fibrous joints because a ligament is what kind of tissue histologically? What kind of tissue is that? It's a connective tissue. Yeah, I like that. And what kind of connective tissue? Yeah, it's bent regular because all of those collagen fibers are going in one direction. And that's why tendons and ligaments can withstand tension in one direction to a large degree. Okay. This I wanted over here. Okay, so we got fibrous joints. Cartilaginous joints. Here we got a couple of cartilaginous joints. During development, that separation between the epiphysis and the diaphysis, there is some cartilage, and ossification is taking place in this region. right? So this is a region of proliferation. Cells are growing, and the bone grows in length at this location. So it looks like a line right here, but you should really think of it as a three-dimensional plate that underlies the whole head of the humerus and pretty much of all long bones. All right, so here is an example of a cartilaginous joint, and this one we call a synchondrosis. What do we call a cell that makes cartilage? Chondrocyte. You see anything that looks like chondro in the name of these joints right here? Yeah, synchondrosis. So that will tell you that it's a cartilaginous joint. Okay, another one is between the manubrium and first rib. So that is also a synchondrosis. And these are really not movable joints either. A symphysis is another kind of cartilaginous joint. Now, that kind of cartilage is going to be tougher. It's going to have more collagen in it compared to the synchondrosis, which is more hyaline cartilage. All right, so what kind of cartilage do we find in symphyses? Because they have to be stronger. So that's fibrocartilage, connective tissue. So the joints between vertebrae allow for a little bit of motion so that you can rotate right and left pretty easily. You can flex and extend a little bit. All right, so these are not completely immovable joints, but they don't give you a lot of range of motion. All right, pubic symphysis is another kind of fibrocartilage joint or a symphysis, and this one pretty much is immovable, all right, except during certain periods of time. And that is during parturition, right? When somebody's giving birth, then there are enzymes that dissolve the pubic symphysis so that the pubic bones can separate a little bit from each other, and that enlarges the pelvic outlet. Right? But in somebody that's maybe 60, 65 years old, it's probably not a fibrocartilage anymore. It's probably just ossified over, just a complete bone. Okay, so those are some structural classifications of joints. And here is the last one. Here is a synovial joint. And this is an important exam figure, so you should know all of these pieces of a synovial joint. All right, so we got done talking about fibrous, cartilaginous. Now here is a synovial joint. And a synovial joint does have characteristics of a fibrous joint, does have characteristics of a cartilaginous joint, plus some other details that we're going to look at. All right, so this is a really highly evolved kind of joint. So here I got a couple long bones, and it doesn't matter which long bones they are. Here is the proximal long bone, here's the distal long bone, and here is the head or condyle of one of the bones, here's the head or condyle of the other bone that's articulating. And can you see that these two bones never come in contact with each other because there's something special covering the condyles, and it is hyaline cartilage, right? Articular cartilage. You have a picture in your mind what hyaline cartilage looks like? Is it strong or is it sort of weak? It's weak because what's it missing? It's missing elastic fibers and collagen fibers, right? It doesn't have much in the way of fibers. Right, so it's very translucent. It has some collagen, but it's in a different form. It's in a dissolvable or soluble form of collagen. Right, and so if the two bones do touch each other, that cartilage protects the ends of the bone, and it acts like a sponge a little bit of a shock absorber, and it's also very slippery so that these bones can slip and slide over each other. All right, so hyaline cartilage or articular cartilage is one component. Then on either side, I see a cavity, and even between the articular cartilages, we're going to call this the joint cavity. So you see a joint cavity, and that also, there's some pressure when you move a joint, and that also helps keep these bones separated from each other. And it can be pressurized sometimes. If you bend your fingers a certain way, you can put a lot of pressure in a knuckle joint, and then you move it a little bit more. So you're putting a real high pressure in one side and you move your finger a little bit more and then all of a sudden it snaps all the way over to this other side over here and it kind of makes a cracking sound. And so sometimes we call that what you're cracking your knuckles when you do that. Probably not too dangerous to do that repeatedly. But it could possibly wear down this hyaline cartilage and produce arthritis, right, later on in life. And the fluid inside of this space right here is what we call synovial fluid, because what kind of joint is this? This is a synovial joint, and we're learning all the pieces, the structure of a synovial joint. All right, so you got hyaline cartilage, the synovial cavity with synovial fluid, and the synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane, which is this next layer here. Right, and the synovial membrane secretes synovial fluid, and there's some nutrients in there, just a little bit of oxygen so that the cells on the hyaline cartilage don't die. And that synovial fluid produced by synovial membrane right here also helps lubricate these hyaline cartilages so that these bones can move with respect to each other without a lot of friction. That's the reason why it's in there. So synovial membrane secretes nutrients into synovial fluid as well as a lubricant. All right, now that synovial membrane is not very tough. So there has to be some other material that make this area a lot tougher so that these bones don't act too weird, so that they stay close to each other. And here is the fibrous capsule that's superficial to the synovial membrane. See a fibrous capsule? I see a fibrous capsule over here. And of course, that's dense regular connective tissue, fibrous capsule, dense irregular connective tissue. So it can withstand tension in a whole lot of different directions, but it's not particularly strong in any one direction because that's what an irregular is. All right, so if we put the synovial membrane and the fibrous capsule together, like I see over here, right, then we're going to call this the articular capsule. Articular capsule is part synovial membrane, part fibrous capsule. So that's a little bit of a tongue twister that you have all these things memorized. And then some joints do have ligaments that go from the proximal to the distal bone or maybe to one that's lateral, and we call that the ligament. So there are ligaments that span joints, okay, that help stabilize the joint, prevent kinds of motion that might actually damage the ends of these bones. Okay. The other thing that, of course, you're familiar with is this membrane that surrounds a bone that's called the periosteum. All right, so this is an important figure that you should just have in your mind because it's an exam figure, and it's a synovial joint. We're going to say just a little bit more about synovial joints in just a second. All right, anybody have a question on the synovial joint? Synovial joint? Anybody have anybody work on any of your synovial joints? Anybody had some work done on a synovial joint in here? Maybe, maybe not. Ah, you have? Okay. See you raising your orange marker there so I don't miss it. Nice. Okay. Well, as you can imagine, as we get older, this hyaline cartilage does get worn down in some joints more than others, and some people more than others. And if somebody has a bone rubbing right on bone, then the bones actually grind each other down, right, and that becomes very painful. So in certain parts of the body, then this whole joint is replaced with a prosthetic joint, like for knees and hips. And those surgeries are actually getting kind of simple, right, and they're very, very successful. But of course, don't volunteer for one unless you really need it. Okay. Okay. Let's look at a functional classification of these joints. Let's see what I have for functional classification. Okay. I don't think I have any slides in particular. All right, but the functional classification is by the degree of mobility, the degree of motion that's allowed at these particular joints. And here they are, synarthroses, amphiarthroses, and diarthroses. And so this arthroses right here just represents a joint. And synarthroses are immovable joints, almost 100% immovable. For instance, a good example was a suture. And a suture is what kind of joint by structural classification?
Fibrous.
It's a fibrous. Yep, exactly right. Right, so you should be able to relate these two different arrangements of words. Amphiarthrosis, right, is slightly movable. And a really good example of that is an intervertebral joint, right, because it allows for a little bit of rotation, a little bit of flexion and extension, but not too much because it's got to protect your spinal cord. Right, and it just so happens that amphiarthroses are what kind of joints? Yeah, in particular, this intervertebral joint is a cartilaginous joint, but there are also some fibrous joints that are amphiarthroses as well, like the interosseous membrane between the bones of your forearm, your ulna, and radius. Right? If that was a synarthrosis, then you wouldn't be able to pronate and supinate, and we're going to look at that definition really, really soon. Okay, and the last kind by function, and this is probably the most common in your body, is what we call a diarthrosis. This is freely movable, and so that can undergo a whole bunch of different motions, and we're going to look at synovial joints where I have the cursor on the right-hand side and learn the names of all these different kinds of motions. These motions are allowed with a diarthrosis, or freely movable joint, for instance, elbow. And it just so happens that in every circumstance, a diarthrosis is going to be a synovial joint. Right, so all of these have to have the structure of that synovial joint that we just looked at. Okay, we looked at fibrous joints, cartilaginous joints, synovial joints. Oh yeah, that's all the stuff we talked about. All right, so how are we going to remember the functional classification? What is that functional classification? Synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, diarthrosis. Should know which one is immovable, slightly movable, and completely movable, freely movable. Well, sometimes we take the first letter of those words that we're trying to remember and make another word out of it, or a saying or something like that. And so let's take the first letter of synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis, and what do you come up with?
Sad.
Yeah, sad, right? And so it's just in the order of increasing mobility. So that might be a nice handy trick for you to remember. So diarthrosis, last letter, so that's the most movable, right? Diarthrosis. And it just so happens, what? Every diarthrosis has to be a synovial joint. Okay. Okay. We're going to look at some other things on a synovial joint. All right, so here is a nice model of a synovial joint that we've looked at. Here are all the components of a synovial joint. Sometimes they have some additional features. So let's look at some of these additional features of a synovial joint. Here is, you're going to look at this in lab today, here's the shoulder joint. Right, so here is the scapula, even the acromion process on a scapula. Here's the head of the humerus, and the head of the humerus fits into, what is this socket called? Yeah, it's a glenoid fossa, glenoid cavity that's on the scapula. And so the head of the humerus fits up against that really nicely. And that glenoid fossa, remember, was not very deep. It's a very shallow depression, and so the humerus doesn't fit into it very snugly. So you have a lot of mobility at the shoulder joint, but what are you subtracting? What are you deficient? Because you're giving that away for mobility. What do you lose when you gain mobility? Yeah, stability, right? So it's the shoulder joint is not as strong as the hip joint as a result of that. Okay, so here I see hyaline cartilage. And then there's a ring of fibrocartilage around the glenoid fossa. Uh-oh, I remembered what it was, and I just forgot what it is. I see a little bit of it right here. Ah, okay. I'll say it before I forget it. This is what we call the labrum. The labrum is like a ring around the glenoid fossa, and it's not bone, so it's not as strong as bone. It's fibrocartilage, and that helps stabilize the shoulder joint, even though it's just fibrocartilage. Right. But, of course, you realize since it's not as strong as bone, it's easy to rip. And I'm not so sure anybody can repair such things. Probably just the ripped pieces have to be removed. All right, so you have a labrum, fibrocartilage, and of course you see the fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, And then you see a couple other things. Well, let's go up over here. Here's something you're familiar with, right? The joint cavity filled with synovial fluid all the way over to here. But now I see a couple other things. I see this thing right here that looks like a pillow. And then I see something that's wrapping around the tendon of the biceps muscle. And that tendon of the biceps muscle, probably, maybe you could feel it, maybe not, but for sure you can feel the intertubercular sulcus or groove on that anterior superior part of the humerus. Right, so it rubs up against the humerus, that tendon, and of course the biceps is a pretty strong muscle. That would cause a lot of inflammation. So here's a special structure that decreases inflammation, and we call this a tendon sheath that surrounds this tendon. And that tendon goes all the way over the head of the humerus and inserts into a little tubercle on the superior rim of the glenoid fossa. Sometimes we call that the supraglenoid fossa for the tendon of the biceps. So what do we have right here? We have a fibrous capsule. We have a synovial membrane and synovial fluid within this wrapping of the tendon. And that's what we call a tendon sheath. So when this tendon moves, it doesn't rub up against the bone, right? And it doesn't rub up against the acromion process, and that just reduces friction and inflammation in this region. And if it's surrounding a tendon, we're going to call that a tendon sheath. Right? But use your understanding of a synovial joint to know how a tendon sheath is put together. Here is something that's pretty similar to a tendon sheath, but a tendon doesn't go through it, but it's packaged very closely to tendons or maybe to muscles. It's going to be between a muscle and a bone or a tendon and a bone. And again, it reduces inflammation and friction between muscles and bones because muscles, when they can contract very rigorously. So here is the fibrous capsule. Here's a synovial fluid. And this is what we call a bursa. And it's right underneath the acromion, so we're going to call this the subacromial bursa. So when you, say, move your arm up like this, we call that abduction. When you abduct your arm, right, then the head of the humerus is going to roll around in this area, and the subacromial bursa will roll right with it so that the head of the humerus doesn't rub up against the acromion process. All right, so here's a figure where you can see it actually rolling around when you abduct and adduct at the shoulder. And that normally decreases inflammation. But of course, if you overuse any of these joints and or use them inappropriately for motions that they're not designed to do, then of course these bursa or tendon sheaths become damaged and they themselves become inflamed, because the synovial membrane will secrete a lot of extra fluid into a bursa. And probably you have all heard of what an inflamed bursa is called. What condition is that when somebody has an enlarged and irritated, inflamed bursa? That's what we call bursitis. Yeah, and any place where you have strong muscles, especially near joints, you have bursa. And the hips, shoulder are really good examples of that. Okay. Every joint? No, not every joint. Only some that have special kind of motions, like hip, shoulder would be good examples. Okay. Knee has them. We could probably, so those would be three really good examples. Okay, knee, hip, shoulder. All right, so when you think of a bursa, what is a structure that kind of automatically pops into your mind? What's the best way to think of a bursa?
A pillow.
Okay, as a pillow, I like that. But in terms of anatomy, what should you model your thinking?
Friction.
Okay, yeah, reduces friction. I like that. Okay, I like to think of it as what? Just like a joint capsule right here with the synovial membrane, synovial fluid. And it pretty much has all the components of a articular capsule. And it just protects these bones from rubbing up against each other and causing inflammation. All right, so those are a couple special structures. Tendon sheath. Another thing. Articular disc or meniscus is fibrocartilage. Let me see if I can find an articular disc. I want to find a TMJ. OK, Can I find a TMJ? Okay, so here is a synovial joint, right, between the mandibular condyle and the mandibular fossa, right? And this is the only movable joint in our skull. And here is hyaline cartilage on the condyle, mandibular condyle. Here's some cartilage, hyaline cartilage, lining the mandibular fossa. But if you go from that cartilage down to this cartilage over here, notice that you see some complexity that we haven't seen before. We have two areas of synovial fluid, synovial cavities. There's one here and one here, and of course that fluid is secreted by synovial membranes. And these two cavities are separated by some fibrocartilage. And that fibrocartilage is what we call an articular disc. Okay, because your temporomandibular joint is really special. Right? We hardly notice it very much, but it's really important because, okay, you can lower your jaw. And that's called depression. You can elevate your jaw. What is that? If lowering is depression, what is? Well, maybe I told you. I forget. I have to go back and listen to the tape. It's called elevation, right? Depression, elevation, opening and closing your mouth. But you can also slide your jaw sideways, to the left, to the right. Can't do that with your knee, okay? And you can also, and be careful you don't chip a tooth, you can move your mandible forward like that, or bring it back to your spinal cord, right? And so that's what we call protraction and retraction. So this temporomandibular joint has a lot of different degrees of motion, and this articular disc right here is important to just help that all those different particular motions, right? It just has the right shape to promote all of those different motions. Okay, another good joint that you should, oh, here is what I mentioned before. I think it's on here. Here's the glenoid fossa. Here is hyaline cartilage within the cavity. Do I see the labrum? Maybe here is a little bit of the glenoid labrum. Let me go back and see if there's a better picture of the glenoid labrum someplace. I thought we had one. Well, we don't. But that's a ring of fibrocartilage that makes the depth of the glenoid cavity a little bit deeper. And then here is a joint that has like an articular disc. They're pretty special, and that is the knee. All right, so here is a nice longitudinal section, a sagittal section through the knee. And so here is the femur, here is the tibia, and I can see some articular cartilage on the ends of these bones. I actually see some ligaments within the joint. Not a lot of joints have ligaments between them, but the hip is another example of a joint that has a stabilizing ligament right in the very center of it. Then, of course, the synovial cavity, which is filled with synovial fluid, right, and that's secreted by a synovial membrane, right? So here's a nice synovial membrane right here. And okay, here's the patella, and that patella moves around depending on how we contract this muscle, and now I see some bursa, right, as well, that protects the knee from becoming inflamed. All right, so here is the infrapatellar bursa, and here's the suprapatellar bursa, and then there's even one that's anterior to the patella. And this is what we call the prepatellar bursa. So bursas are placed all around in different places to decrease inflammation. Okay, well, this is a nice mid-sagittal section of the knee. And we can't see any of that fibrocartilage. So let's maybe look at a little bit different presentation. All right, we've taken the knee apart. And here is, all right, so here's anterior. Anybody know this, what the name of this little bump is right here to give you a little bit of an orientation? Yeah, we looked at it in lecture. You're looking at it today in lab, right? So a lot of people haven't seen this thing in lab yet, but that is the tibial tuberosity, right? Some big, powerful muscles like the quadriceps insert right here. All right, so this is anterior, and here is that fibrocartilage within the knee, and it should remind you of a letter of the alphabet. What does it look like? It looks like a C, right? So we call that a C-shaped cartilage, and it's fibrocartilage, so it's pretty strong. Not as strong as bone, so that also means that it can be damaged relatively easily. And as you go from one tip of the sea to the other tip, it becomes very thin, and it's very thick in this region. All right, so guess what parts of this articular disc gets damaged, if anything's going to get damaged at all? All right, these tips right here, because they're so thin. So sometimes these tips break off, and of course they're kind of wedge-shaped. They're thin on the very tip, and they get thicker as you go back over here. And so sometimes they do get wedged within the knee, and that can actually lock somebody's knee in position when that happens. Okay, also, this articular disc is thin, right, in this inner section, and you can see that it's very thick on this outside border of this articular disc. All right, so these two that have the same kind of shape, we don't really call it an articular disc, but we call it a meniscus, right? And there's going to be a lateral meniscus and a medial meniscus. Probably can't tell from this figure, but when we look at an anterior view, and in lab we'll be able to tell which one is which by knowing what bones you have in the leg. And right now I only see the tibia. I don't see the fibula. Okay. All right, so this is an articular disc, special, and this is a meniscus that stabilizes the knee. And of course it protects the articular cartilage on the tibia and the femur as well.
The function of the bursa either it helps to prevent infection, and how about the function?
Inflammation. Okay, not so much infection. I don't know if I heard you say infection or not, but inflammation. Inflammation, yeah.
And how about the function of meniscus?
Of this meniscus, it's mostly for stabilizing the joint. Okay, so here we have a lot of body weight, right on the knee. And so maybe I'll just kind of show you. Okay, so let's just say here is your leg. And what's on top of your leg? Your thigh, just like that. Okay, so when you put these two bones together, sometimes they would like to slip apart like that, or like that. Or maybe even the leg would like to move out in front of the femur or back of the femur. So these menisci prevent those motions. Okay, so it just allows the femur to settle in very nicely right on the head of the tibia. Okay, but don't forget, there's a lot of weight on it, so it can be damaged, especially if you undergo a lot of force in any of those directions that I showed you, or if you try to bend the knee laterally like that, then that will damage some of these ligaments and also this meniscus. Okay. Movements. Yeah, let's talk about some movements. This is going to be really nice that we can use these definitions now in class. All right, so what do we have? We have a couple bones right here. So what part of your anatomy is this thing? Okay, can you see that okay? Yeah, the ulna and radius. So this is your forearm, right? And then here are carpals. These make up your wrist. Here are the metacarpals that make up your hand, right? And then here are the digits, which we can hardly see, the phalanges that make up the digits. Okay, well, these bones in the wrist are kind of flat in spaces. They are synovial joints, and they are a diarthrosis, so they're freely movable. They can slide past each other, right? So when you move your hand like this, that produces a gliding motion at the wrist. All right, here is a good figure that explains a couple motions that we use a lot in this class. All right, so here, think of maybe somebody has a metal rod or a pin sticking right through their neck, and that metal rod is stationary, and your head is just going to rotate around that rod. All right, and so you can bend your head forward, or you can bend your head backwards like this. So whenever you decrease the angle, so when your head is standing straight up, right, your head is up over here, your body's right over here. It's 180 degrees. It just lines up perfectly, right? And whenever you decrease that angle, right, like we see in what this person is doing here, we call that flexion. Decreasing the angle between two bones is flexion. And when you go in the reverse direction, increasing the angle, that's called extension. Right, so here is flexion. What are we flexing when we do that? What are we flexing? We are flexing, not your head, because your head's up here. It's only got the TMJ. It doesn't move. You're flexing your cervical spine or your neck. Okay, so flexion at the neck is like that. Extension at the neck is like so. What's not on this diagram is something that you can do, but hopefully not too rigorously. Right? You can flex, you can extend, but you can also do what? What do we call that? We call that hyperextension, right? And some joints you can hyperextend much more than others. All right, so let me just see what the next figure is. Let's look at a couple other joints. Oh, well, this is good. So not only can you flex and extend your cervical spine, but you can flex and extend your lumbar. Okay, so here's somebody that's flexing the lumbar, extending. And then if you go past, then that is hyperextension. All right, so you can do that to some degree. Okay, flexion, extension. Okay, let's look at a couple of different other joints. So let's look at your upper appendage, and in particular, the elbow. So can you see that my forearm is lined up exactly with my arm? It's a nice 180 degrees. And if I decrease that angle, that is called flexion. Okay, if I increase the angle, it is called extension. Now, can I hyperextend my elbow? No, I can't. Okay, so no, I don't want to hyperextend my elbow. It's just not designed to do that because the olecranon process fits nicely into that olecranon fossa, and there's no more room other than that. Okay, so you can't hyperextend the elbow. All right, let's use that same logic for, okay, the bones of the wrist. What do we call this?
Flexion.
That's flexion. Here is extension. Here is hyperextension. Nice. What about for my digits? Here is flexion. Here is extension, and I can't really hyperextend. Maybe if I played piano from age 2, I could hyperextend, and it would be okay. All right, so flexion and extension really isn't too difficult to see. Let's do one more joint, okay? Let's do the hip. All right, so right now, just 180 degrees, I want to decrease that angle, so at the hip, so just ignore my leg, just look at my thigh. What's happening? Flexion, right? That angle got smaller. Here is extension, and of course you can hyperextend a little bit as well. Right? So here, this is really a better motion. Here is what? Flexion at the hip, extension. And my knee isn't moving one way or the other. All right, and then of course for the knee, here is flexion, here's extension. So usually it's really easy to understand flexion and extension except for one joint, and that is a shoulder joint. All right, so here's a shoulder joint, and when you're in anatomic position, you're just like this, right? So can you see a 180-degree line anywhere in my shoulder? Where's that 180-degree line that goes across my shoulder? I've never been able to see it. Okay, so how do you know what's a flexion and extension if you can't even see that angle? Well, by definition, whenever you move your elbow or your humerus anteriorly like this, straight anteriorly, that's what we call flexion. And then when you bring it back, that is extension, and then here is hyperextension. So if you're really good at memorizing, then that's easy to understand, right? Flexion, extension. But if you don't want to memorize it, just think of the hip, right? Pair it up with the hip. Because what did we say this was? That's flexion. So this is flexion at the hip and flexion at the shoulder, both. Here is extension of the hip, extension at the shoulder. All right, just think of that motion like that. Okay. Flexion and extension of the shoulder. So here you see that at the knee, extension at the knee, flexion of the humerus or flexion of the arm, extension. Well, this is actually what? Hyperextension. Okay. So that's the only difficult motion in this series. Okay, a couple other motions. And actually, I want to say something about flexion and extension. And wow, I thought of it, but then I forgot when I was talking about it. And this is probably one of the most important parts of the whole class. Okay? And that is, okay, so we have flexion and extension, right? And they're opposite, exactly opposite motions, right? So one decreases the angle, the other increases the angle. And in order to do that, you need some muscles. Now, what can a muscle do? What does a muscle do? Yeah, it shortens, right? It contracts. It just can pull on things. It can't expand. It can't push, right? So how is it that elbow can flex and extend if you don't have any muscles that can actually push it back down? Okay, and that's because you have muscles on opposite side of the arm. The biceps is important for flexion, right? It's attached to some anterior part of your forearm. And then to extend, you need a muscle back here that's attached to the posterior side of the forearm. So that one contracts when the biceps relaxes for extension. All right, so you got to have both of those muscles that have different motions. They're antagonistic to each other. Flexion and extension are antagonistic to each other. And so a lot of times a new student might think, well, gee whiz, it's kind of futile to have two systems in your body, whether it's a skeletal system, muscle system, that work in opposition to each other, that are antagonistic. Why is it important to have antagonism built into your body? This is one example in the musculoskeletal system. Okay, because, let's see, maybe over the weekend, it's Monday already, maybe over the weekend you got pulled over for a sobriety check, right? And the person in the fancy blue uniform and gun and badge said, okay, with your eyes closed, I want you to take your fingertip and put it right on your nose like that. Right, so what gives you that precise control and balance of your fingertip? It is the biceps working with the triceps, right? Antagonistic muscles. So antagonism, in terms of control system, allows precise control and balance. Precise control and balance. Whenever, and you'll find things in the nervous system that are designed that way, endocrine system, right? A lot of different systems that we look at are going to have antagonism associated with them. Okay, what about your car? Did we ever talk about your car and antagonistic mechanisms? I don't think we talked about it in here. What are two mechanisms in your car that work against each other, but you would never dream of driving your car without those two things that are working against each other all the time? Gas pedal, brake pedal. Yeah, exactly right. You don't have precise control and balance of your car without those antagonistic mechanisms, right? And we're going to look at that in a number of different systems in your body. So, I'm sure you can appreciate that if you only had a gas pedal, you could go places, like you could go home after work, but when you got home, what would happen when you got home? Yeah, you just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. Right, so you need both of those mechanisms working together. We call that antagonism. That's probably one of the most important concepts in this class. Okay, so flexion and extension are antagonistic to each other. Here's another antagonistic motion. Of course, what kind of position am I in right now? Anatomic position, yeah. And I can raise my forearm like this, like that. That's not flexion, it's another motion, and this is called abduction. Right, raising your arms up like that is abduction. You can do the same thing with your hip. Right here is abduction, and then the antagonistic motion is what? To bring your arms back down to your side, bring your legs together. That's what we call adduction. Abduction, adduction, and there you have to have a symmetrical position of muscles as well that work in opposition to each other on opposite body compartments. Okay, abduction, adduction. So you can see that here. And guess what? You can do that with your digits as well. Abduction, adduction. Ab, add, right? Okay. Ball and socket joints, like your shoulder and your hip, are really special because they can abduct, they can flex and extend, okay, all at the same time, and they can even rotate all at the same time. So here is this motion. It's kind of like a windmill motion. This is what we call circumduction. This is circumduction. All those things put together. All right, so that's pretty. We're going to learn a lot of motions. Not every single kind of motion, but here circumduction is a composite kind of motion. All right. I mentioned rotation at the shoulder. How are you going to visualize rotation? Well, in lab we looked at rotation of your skull. Right. Here's a left lateral. There's a right lateral rotation. And your humerus can do that as well, and your femur, or the hip joint and shoulder joint. So now I'm rotating. Okay, my forearm is actually staying very, very still. My elbow is not moving, my wrist isn't moving, but my hand is moving because what am I doing? I'm rotating my humerus right here. So what's another good way for you to see that? So I tell you what, I'm going to bend my elbow. Okay, and you're going to see that my elbow doesn't flex or extend anymore. My wrist is not going to flex and extend. But if I do a lateral rotation at my shoulder, what's going to happen to my hand? If I do a lateral rotation here, keep my elbow fixed, my wrist fixed. Here is lateral rotation. This would be a medial rotation at the shoulder. Okay, can you all see that once you bend that elbow like that? Okay. All right, so that's a nice simple test for rotator cuff injuries. Did anybody hear of a rotator cuff injury before? Rotator cuff? Yeah, it's very common because the shoulder is not that strong. A nice, really easy sign of rotator cuff injury is that you can put a lot of pressure for medial rotation, but you can hardly apply any pressure for lateral rotation because it's just very painful right on the shoulder. So this is another reason why we're looking at all of these different motions. All right, so here you have antagonism, what? Precise control and balance. Yeah, go ahead and circle that in your notes. Okay, let's look at some other kinds of motions. Your forearm, so here's your forearm. How many bones you got in your forearm? There are two in anatomic position. Okay, where are they located? Where are they located? What are the names of the two bones? Radius and ulna. Radius and ulna. All right. And where do you find the radius? Lateral. Lateral. Completely lateral. Where do you find the ulna?
Medial.
All right. So here's the radius. Nice and straight up and down. Here's the ulna. Right there. All right. And they're parallel to each other when you're in anatomic position. All right. But what else can we do? With the ulna and radius, right? We can move our hands like that. And I didn't move my wrist at all. I'm just moving muscles in my forearm, right, to allow the ulna and radius to cross over each other. They're just crossing over each other like that. So here they're straight. Here the radius is crossed over the ulna. And here is they're straight again. So that has a special motion. All right, so when your palms are facing anteriorly, we say that they are supinated. Supination is going to this position here. So what's a nice easy way maybe some people think of supination? Because if you supinate, so your palms are facing anteriorly, you can make like a little bowl like this. And what can you put in that bowl?
Water.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't say soy sauce, right? Because soup, right? All right, so here's soup. All right. When you move the palms facing posteriorly, that means your forearm bones are crossing over each other. Palms posterior, that's what we call pronation. All right, so here is supination, here is pronation. Supination, pronation. Okay. Dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. These are special motions at the ankle. And I would demonstrate them, but nobody could see because my feet are way down over there. But maybe I'll do it. Okay, when you try to push your toes into the ground, right, we call that plantar flexion. That's like you're trying to plant your digits or the ball of your feet into the ground. So right now my ankle is plantar flexing. Of course, they can't go into the ground, so that's actually pushing my body up, right? Plantar flexion. When I try to lift my toes up off the ground or my foot off the ground like so, that is dorsiflexion. Right. And we don't really call that extension and flexion because there's some weird twisting that happens during development. So your upper appendage is not exactly like your lower appendage, right? Because if you flex your forearm or flex at the elbow, what happens? Your hand comes anteriorly. But if you flex at the knee, what happens? Where does your foot go? Does it go anteriorly? No, it goes posteriorly. All right, so your lower appendage has been twisted around a little bit. And so flexion, extension doesn't work at the ankle, but plantar flexion and dorsiflexion do. Let me see if I have a little picture? I'm not sure if I have a picture of it. Pretty close. Okay, so plantar flexion is like so. Dorsiflexion is lifting your toes up off the ground. All right, so where do you think you have stronger muscles? For plantar flexion or dorsiflexion? Yeah, because in order to plantar flex, you need muscles that can actually elevate your whole body off the ground, right? So those are very powerful muscles. You don't need very strong muscles just to move the front of your foot up. Okay. And these are all controlled by different nerves that leave the vertebral column. How do these nerves leave the vertebral column to get to these muscles in the leg, the dorsiflexion and plantar flex? That was in lab last week. There is a special hole that nerves have to go through. Yeah, foramen. So it's a foramen. And can you remember the name of that foramen? It is the intervertebral foramen, right? It's the foramen between vertebrae where nerves exit the spinal cord to go to various muscles. Okay, so that's an important place because sometimes that intervertebral foramen becomes occluded. Maybe that intervertebral disc, right, gets damaged and squishes into that space, or there could be ossification of a vertebrae or maybe a broken pedicle or something like that. It's going to impinge upon that nerve. So I know years ago when you went to see a doctor, okay, the doctor would be in his office and you'd walk in like so. And as you walk in the room, a doctor, more times than not, would come up with a really perfect diagnosis of what your condition was and what was wrong with you because they just observed you doing your natural thing. Okay, and today they don't do that because you're in a room, right, because the doctor's running from one room to another and doesn't really observe what you're doing. But a doctor still is going to look at the tips of your shoes. Okay, and why would a doctor want to look at the tips of your shoes? Because some people, okay, drag their feet, right, and rub that first surface, right, the front surface of a shoe down, maybe even the top surface. And that's an important sign that somebody has maybe spinal cord damage, right? So if somebody can't lift their toes up off the ground, they're going to drag them across the ground like that, rub off the tips of their shoes. And so what is that motion that they can't do very well or hardly at all? What is that when you lift your toes up off the ground? Dorsiflexion. Yeah, so some people have problems dorsiflexing, and it's not... Maybe the primary reason is not a musculoskeletal issue. Maybe it's a reason, right? The reason is where those nerves leave your back. Okay, so when somebody can't dorsiflex, then I think the first thing you think about is spinal cord injury, right, at that intervertebral foramen. Okay, so do you think that's important? Do you think that's important for somebody to know whether they can dorsiflex or not? Yeah, why? Oh, yeah, because then you know what's wrong in some part of your body that's really far away from what you observe, right? So you can infer what's going on, right? But what's another important? Anybody think of another important reason? Okay. Could be life or death. Why is this? Well, because if you're dragging your feet, your toes over the ground like that, you could trip on something. And when you're our age, when you trip on something, you can always catch yourself and you won't fall down. But what happens if you're 80 years old and you're walking, dragging your toes across the ground? What's going to happen when you trip? Boom, you're going to fall down, right? Chances are you won't be able to catch yourself. And when we get to be that age, our bones get brittle, right? What do we call that? Osteoporosis, right? So when somebody's that age, when they fall down, there is a big, strong bone that fractures pretty easily, and that is a hip, okay? And that's really a traumatic injury for the elderly. You can't convalesce at home, so usually you have to go off-site, right, in a convalescence home, and then you're in really strange surroundings. You don't have your family there all the time. And a lot of people at that age, when they get to these weird places, they kind of just lose the will to live. It just kind of escapes them. So that's why it's really important, right? One of the reasons why it's important, just to look for these motions and think ahead of time. What are some of the possible consequences? Just in this little simple motion right here, dorsiflexion. Okay, what are a couple others? At the ankle, you can invert and evert. So when you invert, it's rocking your foot over so that you're standing on the lateral edge of your foot. That's inversion. All right, if you try to stand on the medial edge of your foot, that's called eversion. That's kind of hard to do. There are more ligaments that prevent eversion than there are inversion. All right, so it's pretty easy to invert, and that causes a sprained ankle when that happens. And it could possibly break some bones in there, but if you ever evert the ankle, usually that causes major damage within the ankle, because that's supposed to be what the strongest, most stable kind of motion that you perform at your ankle. All right, so inversion, eversion. Where do we have that in here? You have a pretty good example of it. All right, so inversion, when you try to stand on the lateral edge of your foot, eversion, when you try to stand on the medial edge of your foot, like so. And you can see that the degree of motion of the inversion is much greater than eversion. Protraction, retraction, I think we kind of looked at that already. With respect to the mandible, right, you can jut your mandible forward, protraction, you can bring it back, retraction, of course you can do those other things like elevation and depression, which is the next one right here. But you can also protract and retract the scapula, right? You can move your shoulders anteriorly. You can also protract. You can move your shoulders back just like that. So protraction, retraction. Same thing for the mandible, or elevation, depression. And one special motion between a couple bones, and it has to do with your hand. It has a really special structure that make a lot of organisms pretty special, because digit number one, you can move anterior like this so that you can actually grasp something. Right, so moving your thumb anterior like that is what we call opposition, because now it's opposing your other digits. Right, so that allows you to grasp. And where do we have a nice picture of that? Right here. Opposition. Moving your thumb forward like that. Okay, let's take a look at this. Let's just practice some of these motions. Okay, so what motion did I just do? Flexion, extension, right? Flexion, extension. So what about this one? Ah, okay. This is, here's opposition. Okay, so here's opposition. What is this thing here? Okay, what do we call that? Flexion. Oh, I can't keep the, it's not a really, like that. That is flexion. Here is extension. I don't want to move my phalanges, right? I want to move that joint between my metacarpals and that first phalanx right there. Here is flexion. Here's extension. Same thing for this one. Here is flexion. Here is extension, right? So flexion, flexion, okay, extension. Okay, so that, I think that's another one that's maybe a little bit hard to see.
So only the thumb has...
Opposition. Uh-huh. Yeah, anywhere in your body, that's the only thing that exhibits opposition.
Only the thumb.
Yeah. All right, so what allows you these different kinds of special motions? And, of course, there's certain arrangements of muscles that go across the joint, and tendons that stabilize a joint, ligaments that stabilize a joint, that maybe allow meniscus, right, that allow certain kinds of motion. But probably one of the most important factors are the shapes of the bones, the ends of the bones that make up a joint. Probably the most important thing. So we want to look at some shapes of articulating bone surfaces to get an appreciation of what these different kinds of motions are. Okay, so what kind of shapes do we have? What are some of the shapes? Okay, well, we looked at gliding before, right? So gliding means that there's two flat surfaces come up against each other, right? And so this top bone can move right or left, it can move anterior or posterior, and it doesn't allow for any angulation. It's just a sliding over each other. So there's no rotational component whatsoever. We call that a non-axial movement. There's no rotation, and that's a gliding. So the joint just these two flat joints. Now, when you look at this joint, it should remind you of something. What kind of joint is this? Okay, by function. What kind of joint by function is this? What are the classifications by function? This is a hard lecture because usually we don't think too much in terms of function. But okay, there are three classes by function. Okay. Yeah, you're really good, but I want to start at the beginning. Right? It's SAD, right? Synarthroses, amphiarthroses, diarthroses, and of those three, this is, indeed you're right, this is the diarthrosis, right? Because I see some hyaline cartilage right here, so just pretend here's a nice synovial cavity, and we're missing the synovial membranes, of course, but they would all be there. Okay, that is a gliding joint. Okay, so here is a different kind of joint. Radically different structure. It's not flat. Would you agree this is not a flat? These two bones don't have a flat surface. But there is a cylindrical shape on the proximal bone, and then in the distal bone, there is a shape that's complementary, right, to this cylinder, so that they fit inside of each other. And this is what we call, so this allows for flexion and extension only, right, not abduction or adduction, and of course not rotation between these two bones because they're stuck together very nicely. We call this a uniaxial motion, uniaxial. So this allows for extension and flexion. A pretty good example of this joint would be between the ulna and the humerus. Right, and what would that be? That would be just like a hinge joint. Flexion and extension, flexion and extension. That happens between primarily the ulna and the humerus. Uniaxial. Pivot joint. Of course, we all know we can pronate and supinate, and that's because there are special joints between the ulna and radius. The head of the radius is nice and round and can fit into that nice radial notch on the ulna. There are muscles then that can pull on your wrist, that move your hand like that, and that rotates the radius right within this radial notch within the ulna. Right? And again, this is a uniaxial motion. There's only one motion of one axis of motion, and that's a pivot. All right. So when the radius moves in that radial notch like that, what do we call that motion? Pronation and supination. Okay. And remember, there are muscles that pull. That's all a muscle can do. There aren't any muscles that can push your hand back into a supinated form. So there are muscles on opposite sides of the forearm. So there are pronators and supinators. Right. So knowing motions of joints will even help you name some muscles later on. Okay, uniaxial. Biaxial kinds. So here is a dome-shaped bone, like between a metacarpal and the first phalanges right here, or first phalanx, and it's dome-shaped. It's completely dome-shaped where you go from anterior to posterior, right to left, and it fits into like a bowl, right? So here's a nice facet. And what does this joint allow? Flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, right? And so there are a lot of different ways to think of this. Not just one axis of motion, but there are two axes of motion, so we call that a biaxial motion. For flexion extension, if the axis is right to left, if the axis is anterior and posterior, okay, then that would be abduction and adduction, like so. Adduction, abduction, adduction, around this axis here. And that's what we call a condyloid joint. Another kind of biaxial joint is what we call a saddle joint. And this kind of looks like a universal joint that you have maybe in your toolbox at home or on your car that connects your drive shaft up to crankshaft on your engine. And this allows for two ranges of motion, two axes. So here is a medial and lateral axis for abduction and adduction, okay, of that thumb. So abduction, adduction around a medial or lateral, and then flexion and extension, like so, around this anterior-posterior axis. And if you put all of these motions together, what do you get? If you put this abduction, adduction with a little flexion with this particular kind of joint, you get opposition. So you need that fancy saddle joint in order to do that. All right, so you can move laterally, right? You can move anterior or posteriorly, both of these, or any combination in between. That's kind of nice. The last kind of joint sort of looks like, actually kind of looks like this saddle joint almost, okay? But this part over here is going to be a complete dome. And this is what we call a ball and socket joint. And so here's the head. In this particular case, the humerus fits into the glenoid fossa, which is complementary in shape to the head of the humerus. And so what kind of motions can you do with this fancy ball and socket joint? It's something that you couldn't do with this saddle joint. Okay? Yeah. So you can abduct and adduct. You can flex and extend. But the additional motion that you can do with the shoulder that you can't do with the thumb right there is a rotation. Right? Yeah, there's no way I can rotate my thumb. That would be pretty cool if I could do that, but I don't even know how to do that. Even if you started young, right, you would never be able to figure out how to rotate your thumb. And if your thumb did rotate, what would happen? Well, one of these bones would have to break, right, because the shape of that joint just does not allow that kind of motion. Okay, so what kind of joint do you need for rotation? Ball and socket, only kind. Okay. Oh, no, it's almost true. But between C1 and C2, okay, you can also rotate. That's not a ball and socket. That would be an exception. Right. So we would have to say a big no for that one.
What joint between C1 and C2? What
axial? That's that is an axial joint. Uniaxial, okay, that is just going to be, a hinge joint, that's just a hinge joint. Okay, please, sign in sheet, please.